and welcome to another edition of Inside Network Marketing. This is your host, Len Clements, and this is October 28th, 2009, and got a guest today, MLM attorney Kevin Thompson. We'll be interviewing him and talking about the state of the industry and some interesting goings on out there on the legal front. I know it's been a while since I've done a podcast, but this is something that I thought was very timely considering some of the actions that are going on out there that we all need to be aware of, and some kind of landmark cases that are working right now, and some interesting decisions that could be affecting all of us here in the near future. And I thought that Kevin was a great person to bring on the show and actually talk about what's going on out there. Actually, just so for those of you who are not familiar with Kevin, he's actually one of the newer MLM, I guess, specialist attorneys here out there. There's four or five that we all know about for a while now. They've been around there for years, and Kevin has recently went out and kind of hung up his own shingle now and is offering his services to startup network marketing companies as well as established companies, and he also represents distributors as well, too. He's the founder and the president of The Advocate Group, which you can check out at theadvocategroup.net. He had some prior experience before starting the Advocate Group with I think he was the chief legal counsel of the signature management team, which I think is better known as just TEAM, which was one of the largest providers of sales aids and things like that for the network marketing industry for distributors. And while he was working with TEAM, he also worked closely with Amway and MonaVie's compliance departments to kind of ensure that their materials passed the legal review. And during his tenure with TEAM, he also helped kind of guide those companies through some commercial litigation as well, too, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. He's also recently published an e-book that you can get online, again, by just going to his website, theadvocategroup.net, about the changing state of the law here in the network marketing industry. And that book's, again, free of charge. You can download it there. So, again, if you want more information about anything that Kevin does, go to his website, or you can also email him at kevin@theadvocategroup.net. You can also watch his challenge of the status quo, as he says, of the legal industry on his blog called The Next Generation Law, again, at his website. So, again, Kevin, thanks for being on the show today. Appreciate you taking the time to help educate us here about what's going on the legal front in the network marketing industry.
It's an absolute pleasure, Len, and you're one of the best in the business, so I'm honored to be on your podcast. I listen to it whenever you have an update, and you definitely know your stuff, and I think we're going to be able to have a good conversation to help educate some folks about what's going on in this evolving space. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks. Is there anything about your background or your experience or anything like that that I left out that you kind of want people to know? Because you are somewhat new, I guess, to a lot of people out there. You know, there's the Grimes and Reese and Nira and Walk and Babner and all these guys that people just have known for years, and you're relatively new on the scene there. So anything else you want people to know about kind of your experience, your history, or anything that you do?
Sure, yeah. I am new to the space. I've been in the industry for about 3 years, and I started out as a distributor in the quick start business, and that's kind of how I came to know Orrin Woodward. And I worked as Orrin's chief counsel at TEAM, and obviously there was some litigation that happened between Orrin and Amway, and so I was kind of it was baptism by fire. You just learn out of necessity, and I met with a lot of lawyers. I got to work with Grimes and Reese and with various consultants. Learned a lot from that experience. The litigation was heavy. It's still ongoing. And for reasons that I've never really disclosed, I withdrew my representation from Orrin Woodward and started my own practice, largely because I recognize that there's a demand for quality legal services in this industry. There's a lot of startup companies, and you see a lot of companies just get shut down for small oversights. A lot of company executives, they want to make money fast and quick, and they sort of exploit the ambiguity in the law to do so, and they get in trouble. And so what I bring to the table is I'm very well versed in the law. I know where the industry's heading. I've got some relationships with regulators. I help entrepreneurs kind of avoid those pitfalls, and also I have real low overhead, so I can offer good rates, good services at a good competitive rate. I've worked with Grimes and Reese. They're great lawyers. You know, to do a plug for those guys, they've been in the industry a long time. You know, they work with Mel Luca. Gerald Nero worked with Amway. I don't know where he's at with his career right now, if he's going to be involved much longer, but he's a good attorney. So, you know, there's room for more. I can count maybe, seven or eight of us in the whole country that do this. So there's plenty of business for everybody to go around.
Yeah, I think Jerry Nira actually left Amway and also legal counsel several years ago. You know, him and Nira and Walk now, W-A-K. And those two guys are interesting because I find of that set of MLM specialist attorneys. And I don't know if legally you can say you specialize. Is that okay to do now? Because I know at one time attorneys couldn't say they specialize in something.
Yeah, you can. The rules of ethics have some limitations, but for all practical purposes, we all say that we specialize in a particular area. You can't say you're certified unless you really are certified by some accredited group. But I think it's fair to say that we specialize.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. That's pretty much all you guys focus on. And it's interesting because as I see the spectrum of attorneys out there, there are some that are really good, like the ones we've mentioned here, how I make the distinction is when a client comes to them that's doing something wrong or they want to do something wrong, those guys will say, here's why you should stop doing that or don't do it. Where there are other attorneys, which I guess will remain nameless, that'll say, well, here's how you can cover up what you're doing. You can still do it, but you've got to say it this way or do it this way so it doesn't look like you're doing it. And then, of course, there are some attorneys that'll just tell you it's perfectly fine to do it that way, and you know they're constantly getting shut down.
You make a very good point, and I know which attorneys you're referring to, and we won't mention them by name. But yes, Grimes and Reese, they're good about that. I do that as well because personally I've seen what happens when a company is run irresponsibly. A lot of people get hurt. And that's not something I want on my conscience. So what I do is I provide advice. And clients, they're free to disregard that advice. I can't run their business. But I definitely, I feel it's my obligation to explain the risks. And if they want to disregard those risks, that's their choice. But don't use my name to promote your business. And so it is important to explain. Ethically, you can't give advice to a client that is in furtherance of a crime. And so we're obligated to tell them what risks there are out there, the likelihood of a regulatory crackdown, or if they run afoul of criminal law, such as mail fraud and wire fraud. And you're right, there are lawyers out there that say, you know what, the FTC, they only shut down one company a year. You're on the wrong side of the law here, but the likelihood of you getting caught is slim. I don't play that game, and I think that's improper. Plus, I do feel the industry is changing to where it will not tolerate bad companies much longer. I think that the FTC is going to get more aggressive under this Obama administration, and I think you're going to see class action lawsuits ramp up in the near future.
Yeah, it's going to sound like it's already happening, actually.
Happening. That's true.
Well, just to kind of set the tone here and sort of create a basis for, because you and I have talked before, and I think we've become friends, and I think we're on the same page in most issues. There are attorneys out there that, you know, kind of like what we're talking about here, where they kind of set their own bar, and some of them, well, one or two that have no bar, essentially, and then there are some where, you know, they set it a little higher and a little higher, and then in your case, sometimes we have had friendly debates in the past that there's a point where you set the bar so high that you start getting into the realm of things that sort of aid and abet our enemies. I guess the anti-MLM zealots out there and some of the cases that they're trying to make, because they're out there saying that the whole industry is nothing but product-based pyramid schemes on the certain basis and things like that. So one of the challenges, I guess, that we had, which I guess is a good place to start, would be, I guess, your support or contention that the amount of product that's purchased by the distributors themselves is somehow could be indicative of an illegal pyramid scheme. And to start that off, I guess I want to pick a bone with you, something that I told you about a little bit, but I want to kind of save it for this. And that's the article, not so much the article that you wrote, but the way that Tracy Conan exploited it on her blog. Now, for people who aren't familiar with Tracy Conan, I hate to even kind of mention her because every time I do, she almost gets kind of like just giddy with glee that I even acknowledged her. I don't know if you know this, Kevin, but one time she even put a whole post on her blog about nothing more than the fact that she had saw that I had visited her website, and she even listed the search terms that I had looked up.
Oh, my gosh.
Next time it was on my website, and here's the search terms that he looked up. It's like, someone's paying attention to me. Look, look, look. So anyway, but I should probably have a field day with this now. And I want to get into a lot. Just kind of indulge me a little bit here as I want to read just three paragraphs from the article that she cited, because I think it's a good basis for a kind of a segue into this subject. You said that, I'm quoting from your article here, at least the way that she kind of took it somewhat out of context. You say that legitimate network marketing companies pay commissions on the sale of products and services to customers. The issue of legitimacy hinges on the definition of customer and the amount of revenue required to come from customers, not distributors. So not quoting here now, but again, you kind of made a distinction there already that there's a dichotomy between customers and distributors. But anyway, you go on to say, legally, companies are required to generate a substantial amount from customers outside the program. And then you go on to say, you use an example of McDonald's where you say, is it okay if 99% of company's revenue comes from its distributors buying the products for personal use? Would you be suspicious if you drove down the street and saw a sign at McDonald's that said over 1 billion burgers sold and then read the fine print that said 99% of the burgers were bought by franchise owners? If the vast majority of revenue comes from the sales force, it would seem that the only way to advance in the company would be to recruit additional distributors to purchase the product and recruit other participants, and therein lies the problem. And then finally you say, with pyramid schemes that try to appear as legitimate network marketing companies, people under the influence of pro-opportunities might purchase products they otherwise would never have purchased at prices they would never have paid, at quantities they would never have consumed, and all with the hopes of recruiting others who do the same. Now, what Tracy did with this, and understand she's part of what's called the Pyramid Scheme Alert Organization. It's this very small little but very prolific clique of what we call anti-MLM zealots that believe the entire industry should be completely wiped out, and they advocate this on a state and federal level, and they lobby and to completely destroy the entire network marketing industry. That's their agenda. Then she went on to say, here I'm quoting her, Kevin Thompson hires himself out to multiple marketing companies to give them legal counsel. Supposedly he, and then she puts this in all bold, knows his way around the legality of MLMs, just like my buddy Jerry Nira supposedly does. And she's being sarcastic there because her and Jerry have had some spats in the past, some disagreements. She goes on to say, so I was pursuing Kevin's website and came across, and she goes all bold again here, this interesting diatribe about what separates legitimate, quote-unquote, MLMs from illegal pyramid schemes. I've written a lot about Mary Kay Cosmetics. By the way, she's written some vicious anti-Mary Kay websites out there. That's what she's kind of known for. USANA, Herbalife, Prepay Legal, and the like. And guess what? All of them seem to violate the most basic rule Kevin sets forth to be legitimate. You have to sell mostly to people not affiliated with the scheme, but those companies have distributors who purchase the bulk of the products, all these companies. So they're all illegal, she says, according to you. If he, talking about you, really believes what he's written, it seems a better business model for Kevin might be representing those who have been defrauded by MLMs. And I made you aware that she had taken your article and she had done this and she was kind of using it as if you were sort of
in her camp,
reconfirming her position. Yeah, like, oh, look, they are all illegal pyramids. You know, so, and your response, which I understand you're trying to be very diplomatic, and you're much better at this than I did. I used to battle her in her message boards, like on her comment section, and I would cite things that proved that she was wrong and she couldn't deny it. So, by the way, her and Jerry got in a big fight over First Amendment rules. She claims she's this First Amendment advocate. She's all for freedom of speech. She loathes censorship, blah, blah, blah. And then she started deleting all of my posts that made her look bad, as now has blocked my ability to post on her blog. So, this advocate of freedom of speech. But anyway, I digress. The point is that you were much more diplomatic than I was. So you, and I'll just quote a little bit of your response. You said, Tracy, thanks for sharing the content of my article. I'm glad you found it informative. I agree there are a lot of problems currently inherent in the industry. By the way, you and I agree on that. When you mentioned your observation that most companies require recruitment to advance, I would say that a lot of these companies are driven by volume, not by active distributors. Still, if most of that volume comes from the sales force, I would agree there's a problem. I want to be part of the solution in the industry. The bad companies need to be weeded out, and resources like your website help. In addition to representing startup MLMs, I do represent defrauded customers. I will be filing a class action lawsuit within the next 2 weeks against a pyramid scheme. Stay tuned. When you hear about it, I would greatly appreciate some added buzz about the lawsuit. Thanks and take care. Her response to you, and then I'll let you kind of address this, was, I want to be part of the solution too. I have yet to find even one MLM that is nothing more than an endless chain recruiting scheme. I wish all MLMs would go away. They drain billions of dollars each year from millions of families. That money would be used in a much better way rather than flushing it down the toilet in some overpriced crappy MLM products. Now, another anti-MLM zealot, by the way, even came in response to her and supported her, but said something. He was bashing the DSA, like a lot, they even accept all these pyramid schemes, which tarnishes even the good product companies like Avon. Her response to that was, Avon is not, all caps, a direct sales company. I'm sick of them getting a pass on this regard. they are on the recruiting bandwagon just as much as the other MLMs. So I want to point that out just to kind of let you and the other, anybody listening to this, kind of understand the degree of absurdity and irrationality of the person you're dealing with here. She actually thinks that even Avon, with this 100-year-old company in 100 different countries, one of the most product-focused, retail-oriented direct sales companies in history, is also an illegal pyramid scheme and should be wiped out along with the entire network marketing industry.
Right, and what's interesting about Avon is that they have retail establishments now, so clearly their products have legitimate value from people outside the network, or else they wouldn't be stationed in malls. So I think Avon's a bad example, but you know, it's a good conversation starter, and you know, I'm a big believer that there's no such thing as bad press as long as they spell your name right, and I do believe she spelled my name right at least. And you know, I don't want to go toe-to-toe with Tracy because, you know, a person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. And some people, they have very strong emotional and sometimes financial connections to a particular angle. And so to really go toe-to-toe, point for point, you're not going to get anywhere. But where I do agree with Tracy is that, you know what, there is a problem. So maybe here's an opportunity where we can work together to be part of the solution. And here's the problem that I see. I love the direct sales industry. I love the opportunity it presents for people where someone can represent a brand and make sales, make transactions, promote that brand to their financial benefit. It gives people an opportunity that otherwise never would have had one. However, what's happened is that there's a lot of ambiguity in the law, and we can get in that. And I feel a lot of companies have exploited that ambiguity, and the model has sort of been desecrated by some companies. And so I feel like long-term, what's in the best interest of the industry is that these bad companies get weeded out. I have no problem representing distributors that have been defrauded by a pyramid scheme because I feel like, you know what, these companies need to get blasted to get out of the market. Number one, they need to either fix themselves or they need to go under and go away. And what happens is a lot of distributors have disputes with companies, but these companies have arbitration provisions where these disputes get buried in confidential arbitration, and whatever ruling comes out of that process is not precedential. So there's no precedence in the industry. So there's a lot of confusion as far as what's legal and what's not legal.
I completely agree with that. But when the challenge is that the anti-MLM zealots out there, they claim the basis of their case is, if most of the product sold by the company is to the distributors themselves, regardless of motive for buying the product, simply the fact that most of the products purchased by distributors makes them all illegal pyramid schemes and thus they should all be wiped out, that's their case. And in spite of there's all kinds of legal precedent that contradicts that, there's state regulations now that are specifically defined, I think, in six different states, that personal consumption is legal. The FTC has specifically said they go by motive as opposed to the percentage of purchase by distributors. All of this is in our favor, but then when you write an article that says legally companies are required to generate a substantial amount of revenue from customers outside the program, and you claim that distributors are not customers, and I'm quoting here, if most of that volume comes from the sales force, I would agree there's a problem, then you're confirming their belief that, because as I think we would all know, literally all network marketing companies, most of the products purchased by the distributors.
Yeah, it depends on how you define most. I think a lot of your party plan companies are very product driven and they do make sales to non-participants. But here's the thing: as far as the state statutes that you're referencing, that's done largely in part by the DSA. And the DSA, they've done some good things, but they are in business to protect their member companies, and a lot of their member companies have problems. And I wouldn't say I agree with those state regulations, and here's why. Theoretically, in Utah, I can have a business where I sell $1,000 pencils. And if I can recruit 10 distributors to purchase a $1,000 pencil, I can make a good commission. And theoretically, I can say, well, these distributors can sell this pencil for $2,000 if they wanted to. There is a retail opportunity. If those sales aren't happening, what it demonstrates to me is that the people are buying those pencils just to participate in the money transfer scheme. And so it always comes back to the soft science of how do you know? Well, what symptoms does a pyramid scheme give off? And a lot of it is art as opposed to science. And what's important is the motive. Why are distributors purchasing the products? Are they purchasing it to remain eligible for bonuses? Are they purchasing? Are they buying it because they really like it? It's hard to measure that motive. One way to do it, and actually you gave me this suggestion, was to look at if there's a 100-point volume requirement and all distributors buy is 100 points, that should tell you that these people are just buying the minimum to stay qualified. I have a problem with that. And one thing that I feel will be good for the industry, and I want to talk about what Amway's done in England, is by having some type of retail sales rule where it requires distributors to make some outside sales. Right? Distributors can still buy for themselves, and you can still pay commissions on those purchases. I'm not saying that's bad, but there needs to be some type of activity threshold where distributors make outside sales. And if you look at the Amway decision, that was largely the main reason why Amway survived. It had this 10-customer rule. It had that 70% rule. And so I think that's very important. And if you just to kind of go down this road, Amway had a cancer domestically. They had a serious problem. And you know, they haven't come out and publicly said that. But their problem was their sales force focused exclusively on the opportunity. And they focused exclusively on buying all this stuff for yourself and recruiting a downline of people. And that leads to people purchasing stuff that they otherwise never would purchase but for it to be a part of the opportunity. And when that happens, and Lynn, I've seen it, and so maybe my judgment is influenced largely because of my past experience, but I've seen it. People buy this stuff to be part of the movement, to be part of the opportunity, to change the culture, to change the world, to get relationships. They buy it because of this charismatic message. And when the only way to advance in a business is to focus on recruiting, when that is the only way, the problem, the business is flawed. And so I want to say this about what Amway did in England. So Amway had a cancer in England, just like they had over here, and they got called to the carpet by the UK government, the equivalent of the US FTC. And what Amway did was, number one, they got rid of the motivational business, the tool business, because when you have a tool business, there's sort of a conflict because the tool business, the profits are driven by training distributors, so the temptation is to sponsor lots of distributors that need training. Well, there's a conflict there, so Amway kind of got rid of that. And the main rule that I really like is they implemented this tiered approach where a distributor can get in the business, but they can't sponsor anybody until they sell $200 to $400 worth of goods. So they have to, step one is, demonstrate a proficiency in selling. Once you've done that, then go out and sponsor somebody else. But guess what? Before that person can sponsor somebody else, they need to demonstrate a proficiency in selling. It's a merchandising culture.
Just take this in full circle, too, because the very first compensation plan back in the 40s, Nutrilite, which ironically got purchased by Amway, their original comp plan, you had to be a customer for 6 months before you could be a distributor. So it's almost like it's come full circle there.
Absolutely. And you know what? Somebody figured out 30 years ago, and it might have been Dexter Yeager, it might have been somebody else, that you know what? It's easier to recruit 10,000 people that buy for themselves as opposed to getting 10,000 customers. And so this model has sort of morphed over time. And if I was giving Amway some free consultation, I would tell them, you know what, do what you did in England here and push for reform in the industry in this direction, and a lot of their competitors won't be able to hang with them, right? Because what's happened is, and I'll make this point, the Amway pay plan, in my opinion, it all goes back to Amway because they're kind of the godfathers of the industry, and everybody's kind of watching what they're doing. The Amway pay plan does not incentivize recruiting. It doesn't. But a lot of people will still build lots of debt in the Amway business and say, well, we'll make our money on the other side with the tool business. And they don't make a whole lot of money in Amway. Well, what's happening is a lot of competitors, a lot of new companies are starting up with these binary plans, matrix plans that are that really incentivize recruitment. And they say, you know what, guys, if you don't like the Amway business, come over here. You can make a whole lot more money doing what you're already doing. And so you're seeing that shift in the industry where a lot of these recruitment-heavy companies are starting to form. I don't think they're going to be in business very long, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, that's another topic, but just to kind of address it real quick, is that, I mean, some could argue that the matrix and binary plans actually de-emphasize recruiting because your downline can now be created by other people's efforts. You have to actually recruit less to achieve the same size downline. But that could be another topic for another time. But as far as Amway goes, One of the things I've always liked to, because there's a lot of anti-MLM websites out there. I hate to give them credit, but anybody can just Google them and you'll find them, like MLMsurvivor.com, for example, which is kind of the message board for where all the anti-MLM zealots meet and they talk. That really should be called AmwaySurvivor.com, because virtually all of them are ex-Amway distributors talking about this tools business and all the things that happen there, and they're all things that are virtually non-existent in practically every other network marketing company in existence. There is no other company now other than maybe Mona V, only because Orrin Woodward brought it over to them, but other than that one exception, no other company has a tools business like Amway does. In fact, most of them forbid it. Most of them don't even allow distributors to produce their own sales aids. The training's free or at cost. The sales aids that are produced, the company either mandates that it be sold at cost or completely disallows it. So
right.
The whole industry kind of gets painted with this Amway brush, and people have a lot of Amway experience like you have, where you said you've seen all this firsthand, but it just literally doesn't apply to virtually 99% of all of the other MLM companies out there. So they kind of...
As far as the tool companies goes and the heavy recruitment, I would agree with you. But still, a lot of these other companies do have recruitment-focused compensation plans. And we can argue whether or not the binary incentivizes recruitment or not. But still, you have these forced matrix where the only way to make money is to literally fill the spots with active distributors. And there really is no incentive. There's no retail sales requirement. There's no incentive to make outside sales.
Right.
So I would take exception to those companies. But as far as Mona V goes, Orrin wasn't the first guy to bring a tool company over there. It was actually, I don't know, maybe Brig Hart. And they have several tool organizations now. I don't think they have a problem with that. And with Amway, it's just ironic because they're trying to kind of clean their house and get it in order. Right now they license the tool companies and they have to approve all the content materials. And they're trying to control their message. And so... you know, they deserve a little bit of credit there. They're trying to go back to a merchandising culture to avoid being a target. And then you have Mona V comes into play, and it's, you know, I think they'll get there eventually. They'll learn that you just can't take a hands-off approach to these companies because now, more than ever, the mothership companies are being held accountable for what the distributors are saying.
By the way, is Zango. Zango's actually brought someone in to network market their tools. You know, as a separate entity, just their tools. So there are two exceptions there. But again, other than that, as you're talking here, I am listening, but I'm trying to struggle to come up. Maybe there could be sort of a tool subculture a little bit in Herbalife, but that's it. I can maybe think of two, maybe three companies out of literally 2,000 companies that have any kind of like a tools sub pyramid or sub business or whatever it is that you want to.
No, and I'm not shooting at the tool subculture. I'm saying. And I don't want to name any specific companies, but even absent tool companies, they incentivize heavy recruitment, internal consumption.
Yeah, and that
so,
we agree with. There's a lot of
right.
out there where it's clear that people are only buying the product as just a token act to be the quote in the comp plan. But here's where I think we really need to make a distinction between the two different criteria. One is what percentage of product is being purchased by the distributors as opposed to customers, just the raw number. And then secondly, the motive for buying that product. In other words, if a company has 1,000 distributors and virtually all of it's being sold to the distributors, but because they genuinely want the product, they love the product, they would have purchased that product even if there were no income opportunity, I mean, it could be 100% and they would still be a legitimate company. Whereas the same company could have 1,000 distributors and let's say, you know, 700 or 800 of them are just making a token purchase to meet a quota and they never would have purchased that product. They have a lower percentage of personal consumption, but they would be a pyramid scheme. So there's two different criteria there.
Right, and some companies are easy targets, and some it's tough. And even the FTC has admitted as such. It's difficult, and there's this gray area. And I wrote, you know, way too long of an article about defining the gray area. And it's on my website, theadvocategroup.net, under resources. And I did a whole lot of research. Number one, that article forced me to really dive into this material. What is the FTC saying? What kind of behaviors are they trying to prevent? And they are having a hard time. You know, they don't want to come out with a regulation because then it'll put half of the industry out of business, and that will really be a huge disruption. So they're leaving it a little vague, and so what we have to go by is this Omnitrition standard, and hopefully Omnitrition gets clarified in this Burn Lounge decision that we're waiting for. And maybe in this Herbalife trial that's set, there might be some law that comes out of that. but there's just not a whole lot of precedence. But yeah, back to your original point, how much outside sales do you need? Right now, I would say 50%, 51% in outside retail sales, just based on what Omnitrition says. And you have to look at not only what that case says, and it is precedential, and I understand that the case got remanded to trial and it got settled, but you still have that Ninth Circuit opinion, which was adopted also in the Sixth Circuit. And that case, it says if Costco is to have any teeth, which is the original pyramid case, you really can't consider your sales force as your customer. You need sales to non-participants. And what that does, just like what Amway did in England, by having that retail sales requirement before you can sponsor a single person, by having an outside sales requirement, it puts a governor chip on the recruitment process. You really can't preach a charismatic message, hey, this business is easy, get your friends and family, let's attend a meeting. You can't do that because step one is go out and make some sales. So your sales force is going to be very sophisticated, and they're going to be educated, they're going to know the product, they're going to represent the company well. Now, if you have somebody in there that's a warm body that's just consuming products for themselves, who knows what they're going to say to sponsor the next person?
Right.
And
people out there, they may not know or understand the Omnitrition case that we're referring to, Webster versus Omnitrition. It was 15 years ago, and that was a decision where I think the court had ruled in favor of Omnitrition on a summary judgment. It got appealed to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit essentially said, no, this shouldn't have been dismissed. You should go to trial. It basically just, I think, revoked a summary judgment. So there was no definitive, you know, trial and a decision made that said Omnitrition was a pyramid because most of their product isn't retailed. It simply was remanded back to trial, and then it was ultimately settled and never actually, there was no definitive outcome to that, which is why I think there's still some ambiguity. And also should throw in, too, this is the Ninth Circuit we're talking about. This is the one where the Pledge of Allegiance was ruled unconstitutional. It's the most overturned appeals court out there. And they're, in my opinion, kind of loopy. But anyway, they're the ones that said in this case 15 years ago that, as part of their opinion, that Omnitrition could be a pyramid and thus should go to trial to see if they are, because most of the products being purchased by distributors, which of course has been the go-to case for all the anti-MLM zealots out there saying, see, that's why they're all pyramids.
But then that's not fair. Because I'm not an MLM zealot, and I don't want to be put in that category.
I'm saying by advocating that case, you're kind of aiding and abetting the enemy in a way, in that, because they're saying... Well,
absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Omnitrition had a retail sales rule. And if they enforced it, they never would have gotten in trouble. They got in trouble because they had the Amway safeguards. Their defense was, Your Honor, we've got the same rules that Amway has. And what the judge said was that those rules are useless because you do not enforce them. So what I'm saying is, if you have a modicum of some outside sales, it legitimizes a lot. And I'm not saying that distributors can't buy for themselves and you can't earn commissions on downline volume from distributor purchases. What I am saying is it is important to have some type of retail sales requirement before you pay out commissions, because at the end of the day, this is a sales business. And if you don't have a retail sales requirement, I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen, Lynn, where the message isn't on the product at all. It's about building a club, building a community that buys for themselves and recruits more people to do the same. And the message just gets too out of control.
Right.
So
there are definitely companies out there that are doing that. But if
absolutely.
There 51%, though, of the volume needs to be sold outside distributor force. And I don't think there's any legal precedent that's based on. But if if there was, wouldn't that then make every network marketing company in the country an illegal pyramid?
Absolutely not. No, I don't agree with that. I think
what company is moving more than 51% of their volume to retail customers outside the distributor base?
Well, I don't want to get into particular companies, but I know that the party plan type businesses where there is a heavy emphasis on product movement and selling to non-participants, I think those companies are safe. And you know what? We're kind of floating in the gray zone here, but what I'm hoping for is that Burn Lounge clarifies this case, because these very issues are teed up in the FTC v. Burn Lounge case, and I think that will help a lot in this regard, and also the Herbalife trial that's set to happen in California. So we need some more law, but for right now, the rule of thumb in the legal world is 51%, because that's what you have to look at what the FTC say in their lawsuits. And granted, the complaint isn't legal precedence, but when you read their lawsuits against these particular companies, you get a feel for what types of behavior that they abhor. That they do not like. So, yeah.
Right, like in the case of Jewelwe, Five Star Auto Club, there's a lot of case precedent out there where they did come back and they lifted TROs and they said, okay, you're back in business if you move more than 50% of your volume to retail customers. But that did create some confusion and a lot of scare in the industry because a lot of people said, you know, that, well, I mean, first of all, of course, most of the products purchased by distributors because, you know, like, for example, if look at McDonald's corporate, since that's the example that you use. If McDonald's corporate sold most of their goods, all of their hamburger, their buns and everything to only their franchisees, which they do, that obviously doesn't make them a pyramid. The franchisees are who they've brought in to move their products.
But those goods are resold.
No, but the point is that MLM companies hire these independent contractor distributors to move their products to market. So, of course, literally all of the volume sold by these companies is going to those distributors. Now, whether it goes on to retail customers or they are retail customers, that's another issue. But, of course, the distributors are buying most of the product. So if you look at these legal precedences that say more than 50% of it have to be going to non-distributors, you know, that the company moves out, then that would make them all a legal pyramid. So the DSA said, well, that's kind of scary. So they asked them for an opinion on that, and the FTC specifically said that, I'm paraphrasing, but we're throwing the book at these companies because they're exceptionally bad apples, and these legal precedences do not represent the current state of the law. They were very, very clear on that. This is not...
Well, yeah, but in that same letter, and again, I'm not sure if there's a right or wrong answer, and we can dance around this for a long time, but in that same letter, James Cohn said that simply having a product does not legitimize a network marketing company. So just because you're moving a good, if the product cannot be incidental to the pay plan. And so all I'm advocating, and I think you would agree, is have some type of retail sales requirement that's put on distributors before they earn bonuses. So if distributors can move, in Amway's case, 50 points worth of products, that's great. Give them a bonus. If you don't have a retail sales requirement, then it's a free-for-all. Then literally the message can be charismatic, and people end up buying stuff they never would buy at prices they never would pay in quantities they would never consume. I mean, you look at some of these requirements in various companies where it's $300 worth of juice. I don't understand that. From what you're telling me, you see really nothing wrong with that because the distributors are being their own best customer, but really they're buying it to participate in the compensation plan.
It goes back to motive, which is what the FTC did say in that letter that is really what they look at. That's the criteria. Now, there's two different criteria, the raw percentage of product being purchased by the distributors and the motive for doing it. So if most of them are buying it because they actually want it, that's fine. If a smaller percentage of the distributors are actually buying the product but just to meet a quota, I still think that's a legal pyramid. So I think it's exclusively about motive, and where it gets great is that things like, you use McDonald's as an example. I used to use Ford dealerships. I would say, if Ford said, I want to buy an F-150. I go to the Ford dealership, and they say, you know, if you're a Ford employee, you get a 35% discount on all Ford vehicles. Well, but I don't work for Ford. I can't get that. Oh, wait, all you got to do is go to a website, fill out a single-page form, pay a $25 annual fee, and you can be an employee of Ford and get this 35% discount. Now,
everybody would do it.
Every single Ford F-150 purchaser would be a quote-unquote Ford employee, like your McDonald's analogy. Where it kind of falls short is that if it did say 99% of the burgers were bought by franchise owners, well, if McDonald's said, fill out a form and everything for the rest of your life is 35% off, every McDonald's customer that plans on eating there more than a couple of times is going to be a quote-unquote McDonald's employee. But that's literally the MLM industry, in its effort to be less risky and to be less legally vulnerable, ironically, has said, look, if you want to be a distributor, some companies, it's free. It's literally free. You simply fill out a form online and you're a distributor for this company. I can only think of two companies, USANA and the one I'm with, so I won't mention them, but that have a preferred customer program where the price is the same as the wholesale price of distributors.
Monavie has it as well, and Amway has it as well.
But the point is, if you're going to be a regular customer of the product, why not just pay the $25 fee and sign up and be a distributor and get it at the wholesale price? If you're
right.
A distributor and you're not doing the business anymore, but you genuinely like the product, I'll just pay my annual $25 renewal fee and keep on auto ship and keep getting it cheaper. Now, where it breaks down is the moment they don't make money, they get off of auto ship because they're not really buying the product because they really want it. They're buying it because they have to meet a quota in the plan. So again, it goes entirely to motive.
Yeah, and I get your point. I wouldn't disagree with you. I think a lot of these companies, they need to have, they don't need to undercut their distributor's ability to make retail sales. And if the barrier to enter as a distributor is low, it's going to completely undermine their ability to make sales. And so a lot of these companies are going with a preferred customer route. That's one way to measure it. So therefore, a person can get in and get the wholesale pricing without signing up as a distributor. And remember, when people sign up as a distributor, they're signing a binding contract. Typically, it contains a non-compete. It contains a non-solicitation provision. It contains an arbitration provision. They're agreeing to some pretty remarkable terms. And to do that, just to enjoy wholesale pricing, it's a pretty big commitment. Now, all I would say is that's fine. If they want to be distributors to enjoy lower cost goods, I've got no problem with that, but still have some type of a retail sales rule that forces distributors to make the outside sales. Because here's the deal. The ultimate metric as far as whether or not the products are marketable is if non-participants buy. The only objective metric that we have as far as whether or not these products are marketable is if non-participants are buying it. And so I'd like to see some sales from non-participants to show that these products really are, they do have value, and that distributors aren't just buying it to participate in the pay plan, that, you know what, these products are good, they have legitimate value, and the intent to consume it is with the best of intentions.
Imagine the distributor that says, okay, I've got to have 5 customers who are not distributors in my downline. But yet, this industry has been, you know, we've taught this for years, that your best prospects are your customers. They already like the product. They're already consuming it because they generally want it. If they like it, they're probably already recommending it. So those are our best prospects. So we go to
customers,
our
customers. Absolutely. Customers are good for business. And if they start as a customer and become a distributor, that's totally fine.
But you created a huge incentive now for, I got my 5 customers. I don't want one of them to become a distributor because I got to go find another customer. If all 5 of my customers become distributors, I don't get paid because I don't have my 5 customer rule met, assuming that, say, that was the quota that they enacted to prove you have customers. It disincentivizes us ever wanting to convert customers to distributors.
Or you're assuming that there's a finite market there. You can keep racking up. Why get 5 customers? Why not get 10? Why not get 20 customers? Some of them will become distributors. Some of them will stay customers. Don't just get 5. It is a sales business. These guys are charged to represent a brand and make sales. So don't stop at 5. Get 20.
Right.
Get 30.
But naturally want to, I agree that the preferred customer, you know, issue may be the answer, the preferred customer program, but I'm technically right now a distributor, I think, for 4 different companies. 3 of them, of course, I don't build in, but I'm even on auto ship in 2 of them. One I'll even plug, Jerky Direct. I mean, I would never be a distributor for that company, but I'm on auto ship for their jerky because I love their jerky. They're counting me as a quote-unquote distributor, but I'm just a customer. So there's a lot of situations like that, and I think that there's – And there's also this challenge with once the distributor has the inventory, how does the company prove what they've done with it? If you say, well, fill out a form, which some companies have, that show you have 5 customers, well, Equinox had that. You got to send us a form every month showing who your 5 customers were.
But they didn't enforce it.
Of course, and they would just go to their friends and family and say, you didn't really buy anything, but fill out this form and say you did. So it's like only the rule breakers are the ones who are going to benefit from it. So I mean,
I agree. What we're hitting upon is that there is some ambiguity in the law, and it needs to get fixed. I'm a big proponent of fixing it. We need to define what the standards need to be, and all I have to go by is the cases that are out there. And Omnitrition is precedence. Granted, it's Ninth Circuit, and the fact that it was remanded to trial. Doesn't matter. The court spoke very clearly, and we're all counting on Burn Lounge to add some clarifications to these issues. And really, until that happens, you and I can do this for days.
I know. And the fear in the industry right now is that case precedences like that, they are going to disregard motive and go with just here X percentage has to be sold to non-distributors, and that's what the Burn Lounge case is going to identify, which again is going to be horrible, I think, for this industry because that's not what really defines a pyramid. It goes to motive. In the Burn Lounge case, and hopefully they'll look at this the right way, and they'll go by the second criteria, which is motive. Because in the Burn Lounge case, it's obvious. there is no ambiguity that you, the 99-cent music downloads isn't where you made the money. It was
absolutely
what was
website
it?
Sales.
Was it $4.95? What was the website sale?
I think it was under 400, and it was it was basically the registration fee. So they were capturing money during registration, and they were
right.
using that to pay out their distributors. So that's a huge red flag.
It was a sign-up fee that clearly no one would ever pay unless you were going to be a distributor. It's like the travel booking website and YDB Travel. That's why they got in trouble, because travel, obviously, you can resell. But who else would buy a travel booking website but a new distributor?
But see, on the one hand, you and I do agree that it is important to have something that does have legitimate market value from non-participants. Because in the Burn Lounge case, they can easily say, well, our distributors are our customer. They're consuming this website. But the reality is it needs to have a legitimate demand from people outside the program.
Right.
So
wouldn't that be something that would almost be nonsensical to claim that there's a retail market to that? It'd be almost like saying, you know, I have a brochure to sell my jungle juice, and we're going to pay commissions on the brochure. The jungle juice, we can argue back and forth, is there really a retail market at that price, blah, blah, blah. But the brochure, what jury in their right mind would ever say there's a market for that brochure beyond the distributor base? It becomes
right.
almost absurd, you know, when you start arguing some of these things that clearly only distributors would buy. Where
you sure beat up on these jungle juice companies. I tell you what, Len, I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. The one which we won't name.
That's a joke.
Litigation coming up. I know. I got it. Yeah, I actually have a sense of humor. It's hard for people to believe. But the company that you're filing the lawsuit against, you and I agree that that's a pyramid. I think it's obvious based on substantial anecdotal evidence that only people are buying that product because they have to meet a quota. They never would have purchased it otherwise. But where that's going to get weird is because you know that during trial, should it ever go that far, which it probably won't, they're going to parade a conga line of their distributors through that witness box saying how much they love their products. Of course I would have purchased it even if I wasn't a distributor. I love it, love it, love it. They're going to give you an ever-sized mountain of affidavits from their distributors telling how much they love the product, blah, blah, blah. And without, I don't think putting them all on lie detectors, which isn't even admissible, or having a mind reader come in, which I'm sure wouldn't be admissible, how are you going to prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence that their motive for buying the product is just to meet a quota in the plan? Now, if they were to pay commission, say, on their product sales website or their brochures or their distributor kit, then it just gets absurd to argue that obviously they're just buying that to be a distributor. But their product, which I agree is just a throw-in juice to have an excuse to exchange cash. You and I agree on that. But how do you prove that in a court of law, that the motive for buying it really isn't pure?
Well, you look at how their policies are structured, and if there's an inventory loading requirements to remain in the business or to obtain a bonus, then that there is indicative already that consumers are just buying the minimum to collect their checks. And so that there is indicia of motive. And there are a number of other factors. How many, assuming there's a non-participant program, or I'm sorry, a preferred customer program, how much sales is that program racking up? And in our view, it ain't going to be many. So there's ways to do this, and you also have to use Omnitrition as precedence, you know, whether or not you like it or not. That is the law in the jurisdiction. So I think it's a good case. What I would like to see, and we can talk in specifics once the suit's filed, but I want to see people get their money back, and I want to see this company fixed, because I think this company could have a future in the industry. You know, they need to call Grimes and Reese, and they need to let those guys fix the business. You know, the goal isn't to shut people down. It's to make consumers whole and to fix the problem. And that's the objective.
So when you have 100 affidavits and say 20 or 30 people get on the stand and they say under oath, I love these products, I'm buying it because I want them. And you say, well, why are you buying just your minimum quota?
Exactly. Exactly. Right.
I don't know. It's a rhetorical question, I guess, but how do you prove motive? I just don't know how you can do that. There's, like I said, there's anecdotal evidence, because you and I have discussed that, you know, if you look at one of their sales reports, every single person is doing to the penny what their auto ship kit is. There's clearly no retail going on. But again, when they all are going to claim that we all really want this product,
You're right, and that's going to happen, but full circle, one thing that we point to is that if this stuff really had that type of legitimate market demand, how come nobody's buying it outside the network? And I know we've already had this debate for the past 30 minutes, but there needs to be some proof that this stuff can make it in the marketplace, that it has value to retail customers. That is the only objective metric that I can think of that proves the legitimacy of the product line. And I think you and I would agree, we agree on this, that there's nothing wrong with having some type of retail sales rule. Again, it was instrumental in Amway's survival. So I think every company out there needs to have some type of retail sales rule where they can demonstrate our distributors do move this stuff to customers, right? We're not just a recruitment organization. We do want customers. It is a business designed to move products into the marketplace, not to recruit an enormous downline of people, because back to what I've said, when the focus is exclusively on recruitment, then the message gets wacky. It gets crazy. And it's not something I'm comfortable endorsing.
And the only thing I think where you and I really depart is, again, on the specific criteria of just the majority of sales going to distributors, not motive. Because if we do go, again, going, and I don't want to belabor this point, but if you go over the 50% threshold, at least 50% or more have got to be moved to non-participants before it's commissionable. And I do agree that there are the Tupperwares and the Avons and the Party Plan programs that maybe fall out of that realm, but just off the top of my head, USANA, Herbalife, Prepay Legal, because those are the ones Conan listed, Jackley, we were looking at Zango, Agile, Mona V, Vima. Pretty much I'm going to be listing about 2,000 MLM companies, about 95% of them maybe, are all going to be legal pyramid schemes based on that criteria alone, not motive. Because, by the way, some of these companies I just mentioned, they're nuts to a fault about their product. I mean, they're really buying it because they really love their product, which is kind of bizarre considering some of the prices, but nonetheless, I do know people that are really passionate about their products. But nonetheless, forget motive. We just look at more than half of it going to non-distributors. You are literally wiping out 95% of your potential consulting and clientele here. So all of those companies, which I think you would agree are good, legitimate companies, maybe at least most of them you would, but based on that criteria, even they're illegal and would get shut down.
It depends. I don't want to endorse any of those companies because I don't know anything about them. But if I saw the data and I saw that the product was moving to non-participants, I'd feel better about that company. And I think in this industry, you have to choose, the name of the game it's evolved into, you don't have to be the best, you just need to not be the slowest, right? Because the FTC shuts down one company a year and you got a few class action lawsuits. So as long as you're not the stupidest company out there, you're not going to get messed with. It's the egregious companies that get pursued. This company we're suing, they're terrible. It's very egregious what they're doing. It's clear. Some of these companies you mentioned, it might not be so clear, but I won't go so far as to endorse them. And I've got no problem. Look, if it is a 100% recruitment-driven internal consumption, then yeah, I take exception to that. I've got no problem with those companies going away because I feel like the industry has a bad reputation, largely because of these recruitment-focused companies, because these distributors make these outrageous claims. People get in the business not really knowing what they're getting involved in, and they buy products, they bring their friends and family, they buy stuff they never would buy at prices they never would pay, and they're not able to recruit a substantial enough downline to make a profit. They quit. They're pissed off, and that's bad for the industry. That's where Amway's negative reputation comes from, whereas if you have a merchandising culture, an educated sales force, you don't have those problems. So one way to fix the image of the industry, this industry, the image will never be repaired until they find a way to figure out how to transition from a recruitment culture to a merchandising culture. You're always going to have the stigma of, oh, network marketing crap, the bring your friends and family, let's all join, let's all buy this stuff for ourselves. That's the perception, and that needs to change.
And I think we agree on this. It's just a matter of where we put the bar. I think what's the highest pole vault?
High jump.
Yeah, high jump.
Yeah.
What is it, seven and three-quarters feet or something like that?
The world record's 8 feet. I jump 6 feet, 10 inches.
Is it 8 feet?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of saying that I'll maybe put it at 6 feet. So, you got to be really good and have a lot of retail and good product focus. But if you kind of put it at 8.5 feet, then nobody can cross over it, or maybe 99% can. So I think we're only apart on where do we put that bar. We definitely need
that. I'll support you. I think if you put the bar at 30% outside retail sales, a lot of those companies you mentioned could get over that, and a lot of the really stupid companies couldn't. Let them go away.
I want to use USANA as an example because I really support them. That was the other company, by the way, who I'm not only not a distributor for, I'm actually, like I said, a distributor for a competing company, yet I'm still on AutoShip to this day for USANA products because I like their products. That's another company that I just buy their product because I like it. They have over 70,000 preferred customers who said, I just want this product. I don't want to be part of the distributor base. They have a less than 2% annual return rate. They will pay people to return their product and less than 2% return it, which is pretty indicative of they want the product. They're consuming it or doing something with it. Yet, based on your definition, USANA would be shut down as an illegal pyramid scheme and 800 W-2 employees would be out of work and it's a publicly traded company. All those investors would lose their money, but that's clearly a product-focused company.
Well, if they have no outside retail sales, that's a problem. And one thing you can look at is the attrition. How many people are quitting? And if you look at the people that quit, how many of those people are actually purchasing products after they quit? And you might be an anomaly, but if most people, when they quit, if they stop buying it, that's also indicative that they were only purchasing the products in the first place to participate in the plan. So again, I can't comment on USANA specifically, but if the elements are there, yeah, I would say
most distributors quit probably in the first 90 days, and that's nothing wrong with any particular company or the MLM model. It's just when it's literally free or $25 to get in, people quit very easily, and there's no they paid $1 million franchise fee. You're not going to see an 85% annual attrition rate like you do in network marketing. You pay for a $25 kit. A couple of people say no, screw this. I'm done with it.
So right, but this goes beyond. This goes beyond. I'm not talking about just the attrition rate because the attrition rates in recruitment schemes are very high.
The point I'm making is that, and I'm using just USANA as an example here because I'm familiar with them. You get 100% of your money back on your product in the first 90 days. It's 90% for a year. So in less than 2%. Return their product in a year, even though their publicly disclosed numbers say they have something like, I forget what the exact numbers is, but about 75% annual attrition rate. Isn't that indicative that they've used this product, they've consumed it? If it's still sitting there,
I agree. And
send it back, But
yeah, most people, you're right, but people are going to consume products and get on AutoShip with the expectation of recruiting other participants that do the same. And so people aren't just going to order stuff and throw it in their garage. It's going to be consumed. So I agree with that. And we're getting into a whole other area here.
I think we've went as far as we can go with this. I think that we may have to just kind of agree to disagree on where the bar is set, but we definitely need a bar. I mean, there's no question that there's got to be products out there that where the motive is because you really want it. And you and I agree that there are a lot of companies out there where it's obvious people are just buying the product because they have to meet a quota, and these are companies that sat around and people said, let's start an MLM company. What can we sell? We need some excuse to exchange cash. I don't know if you've seen this, but even the gold and silver programs are coming back now. It's like saying, I'll sell you four American quarters for a dollar, or worse, I'll sell you four American quarters for $1.25. Then we have 25 cents to put in my comp plan. It's just an alternative form of currency. But even they're coming back now. So
it's Disney dollars.
Yeah, the industry is getting rough out there. I mean, one of the reasons why about a year ago, I the company I had most of my success with kind of went away, so I went corporate twice. I'm 0-2 in my corporate ventures. I'm 2-0 in court against my ex-partners. But
remind me not to be your partner because I don't want to be in litigation.
The thing is, that's another issue, but they all seem like such good, competent, honest people when I first met them, The point is that, I was ready to go back to law school. UNLV started a law program back in 06. I was going to go back to law school and reboot my career because this industry, and I think we have to practice some tough love with it sometimes too, but, I'm an advocate of it. You are an advocate of network marketing. You're obviously not an anti-MLM zealot. You advocate the industry. You want to see it get cleaner and better and become a better corporate citizen. We both agree on that. And I was so just disgruntled and disillusioned with the industry because there was just so much crap out there, I was ready to give up on it. Because not that there aren't some good companies, but when I look at all these good companies, I find I have to start grading on a curve. it's like I just couldn't find an A-plus company where just everything – maybe it's because I know too much of my own good. You know, I know where all the bodies are buried and where all the holes are and all that kind of stuff now. But there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of stuff out there that looks great on paper in theory. I just saw another company recently where they said that they pay out 55%, and I looked at their points and found out that it's 55% of two-thirds of the volume.
They actually
have one of the lowest payouts in the industry, not one of the highest, because they know people are never going to – they're always going to look at the percentages in the comp plan. They're never going to look at BV, the wholesale ratios. They exploit the naivete and I guess the ignorance, for lack of a better term, of the typical prospect that just doesn't know how to review companies.
Right.
There's just so much garbage out there. So we and I don't mind, by the way, raising the bar. I think it does need to be higher than where it is, for sure.
You know, there's going to be some law that comes out of this Obama administration. I think the FTC, they've already expressed an interest in getting more active in the industry. So we'll see what comes out of that. You've got these new disclosure rules that are coming out as far as how to handle testimonials. And what's going to happen is companies are going to be held strictly liable for the representations made by their sales force. And so for the companies with a very unsophisticated sales force, people that really don't understand what type of business they're in, they need to be a little bit worried, whereas the companies that really emphasize selling in order to obtain a bonus, those distributors are going to be careful. They're going to be more sophisticated. You're not going to see the crazy stuff on the internet. So that's a small play. There's going to be more lawsuits. So we'll see what happens. I think the next 5 years, it's going to be very interesting. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll have a better idea for where this industry is going to head, because that burn lounge decision was supposed to be published a couple months ago, but they're taking their time.
Right, and I know we're about out of time here, and I didn't want to leave a couple of issues hanging. We also have this issue now where, first of all, one thing we haven't discussed yet is the SEC inquiry of prepaid legal, which wasn't just on a stock issue. They've actually requested attrition rate data, retention rate data, you know, return rates and things like that, which I would think would go more toward a pyramid-type issue. So there's some scrutiny going on there. We know that there was yet another lawsuit against Herbalife, against, ironically, ex-distributors, very successful distributors, that left Herbalife, went to Melaleuca. They got sued, and then they countersued and said Herbalife was an illegal pyramid scheme. All the riches that they made on Herbalife before they left was in an illegal pyramid scheme, is what they're claiming now. Herbalife tried to dismiss it because they've been hit on that many times. Herbalife obviously has always been victorious or settled because they're still here. But this time the judge said, we're not going to dismiss it. This is going to go to trial, which is weird because, how many times did he have to pass that kind of scrutiny, and yet here they are going to trial on the issue of being an illegal pyramid. By the way, on the basis that most of the products purchased by distributors, which is really ironic considering they all went to Melaleuca, which is basically a wholesale buyer's club.
Right. You know what? When distributors sue companies, you have to follow where they go, and usually they never change their behavior. So they sue companies because they want something, and then once they're free, you'll be amazed. So I'm not surprised to hear that.
Yeah, they probably want them to drop their suit. But just the point is that Herbalife's going to have to go to trial, or if not settle, on the issue of being an illegal pyramid. And then we have the Amway issue, which we touched on a little bit. I guess there's sort of a two-way kind of a decision here. In one sense, Amway was defeated, I think, in Utah on the issue of their arbitration clause. They
Correct.
Were forcing distributors to go into arbitration even after they had resigned or were terminated, and they said, well, that doesn't last beyond the contract, so you can't force them into arbitration. But then counter to that, I believe it was Orrin Woodward and some other people, in an arbitration case, recently were just Amway was awarded, I believe it was $12 million something dollars in Woodward's case and $9 million in another person's case, because the ruling was by the arbitrator that the downline was Amway's.
Right. Those are two interesting developments in the industry, and I don't know how much time you want to develop. Maybe it's best for a part two. If you like, we can talk about it.
Can you give us just a brief overview of what happened, maybe in just 10 minutes or something? And if we need to go into more detail on that, maybe we can pick this up another time. But just touch upon your opinion of what happened in those two cases, just fairly briefly.
I was personally involved, and I can't disclose confidential information, but Orrin resigned / was terminated, it depends on who you asked, on August 9th, and a class action lawsuit was subsequently filed against Amway, alleging them to be a pyramid. And Amway then started their arbitration process. Long story short, Oren and those class action plaintiffs had to arbitrate their case in Michigan. And so typically arbitration rulings are confidential. But for whatever reason, Oren tried to have the order vacated. And so Amway had to go to the court in Detroit to get the order enforced. And so they attached the arbitration award to their motion. So now it's publicly available. And those guys owe, you know, something like $25 million between three people over the issue of the LOS. And in Amway's position, their LOS, their line of sponsorship, genealogy network, whatever you want to call it, it's been developing for over 50 years. And so what they're doing is that they're just trying to protect that downline. They don't want distributors to walk away with large chunks of the Amway business. And Amway says, you know, your personals, the people you personally sponsored, feel free to take those people. But as far as the genealogy and the network, that remains with Amway as proprietary trade secret. Oren had some compelling arguments to say, well, you know what, they're my customers, because he had a separate tool business. They litigated, and according to the arbitrator, she just wasn't persuaded. And you know, that arbitration award, it's not really precedential. It's not precedential at all. It's just an attachment to a motion.
Right, like a jury verdict or something like that.
Exactly. It can't be used. But what it is, it's at least illustrative of the fact that when distributors leave, it's a hard case to win as far as who owns the LOS. And you hear about it a lot. A lot of distributors hop from company to company. And a lot of companies have the same LOS rule that Amway has. They say, we own the network. That network would not develop but for our business. The distributors say, no, it's not about the business. It's about me. It's about leadership. And both sides have really good arguments. It's hard to take one side. So that's sort of the arbitration award. And this whole thing in Utah, Amway sued several other distributors in arbitration, like they did Oren Woodward. And these guys consolidated in action and brought it to Utah and said, okay, we're all similarly situated. We don't think this arbitration thing is fair. And so the Utah judge just said, you know, Amway can't pursue arbitration against former distributors. They can still perhaps do so against current distributors, but guys that are out of the business, that are in other activities, such as these folks that filed the Utah action, Amway has to sue them in public, in federal court, state courts, whatever.
And that
so that's what that
precedent.
Excuse me?
That was a court precedent.
That is precedential, right? So that doesn't bode well for it's hard to interpret because it applies to former IBOs, and in this circumstance, you know, those guys were out of the business for almost a year before the Amway commenced the lawsuits and arbitration. If current distributors in the Amway business wanted to bolt and leave Amway, Amway can probably still commence an arbitration proceeding against them. However, if people have been out for a long time, you know, at least for the time being, they're free from suit in Amway's arbitration. Now, of course, Amway's going to appeal it. They're very aggressive and they're very disciplined, and they might pursue these people in state or federal court. It's hard to predict where this thing is going to go.
First thing that kind of struck me is considering the additional speed and less expense of arbitration. Why would someone fight against going to arbitration? Usually, don't you see plaintiffs or defendants fighting for arbitration?
It depends on the context and the company, and a lot of distributors are more comfortable fighting Amway in public because of a lot of the discovery is public. In arbitration, it's all confidential. Mm-hmm. So the main lever isn't there in arbitration. And in arbitration, as stated by that judge in Utah, it's pretty expensive.
Now, and since this is the argument there is that, well, these policies that you're operating under don't survive beyond your distributorship. You know, once you're terminated or you leave or you're suspended or you resign or whatever, how do you think that affects things like non-competes, for example? You know, in other words, someone says, you know, you're not a distributor for our company anymore. You got terminated or you resigned, but for 1 year, you can't join another network marketing company or you can't talk to anyone that you sponsored in the previous company or any of these types of non-compete clauses. Wouldn't those also not survive beyond the life of the distributorship as well?
Well, that's a good question, and there's a good body of case law developed about non-competes, and typically they do survive termination, and it expressly says in Amway's contract 6 months after resignation or termination. And with the arbitration provision, that wasn't in there. Amway recently amended their rules to where the arbitration applies to former IBOs. However, the contract that these defendants were under, that little, those two words weren't in there. It never said former IBOs.
Right.
So it just depends on what the agreement says.
Yeah, and this is, by the way, the last point, just so you know, because I know you've been spending a lot of extra time with me here, but there is a lot of things going on right now with non-competes in the industry. I know back in the, I think it was Mark America versus Rossi case, where the non-compete was thrown out because they said, well, you can't have a non-compete when you're independent contractors. You know, that'd be, and this is my analogy, it's kind of like if I hired someone to paint my house and I said, come in anytime this weekend and just get it done, because that's an independent contractor, you're not an employee, so as long as you get it done by the end of the weekend. But after you're done painting my house, you can't paint any of my neighbor's houses for 6 months. You know, I mean, I don't know how that applies to an independent contractor. So,
you know what, it's there's really good points on both sides of that argument. And in the MLM space, they say you can't sell competing products for 6 months, but you're free to do another MLM. Still, you know, there's just not a lot of law on that particular subject. I kind of understand it because what MLMs want to do is when a business develops and a distributor gets upset, they want to make it difficult for that person to leave, because if they leave, typically their downline follows the leader. They're not so much loyal to the company. So the non-compete is one additional hurdle to where there's a 6 months cooling off period. Okay, you can quit our business, just don't sell competing products. You know, don't leave Monavi and go to Zango. That's, I don't know. I can see it both ways.
Yeah, I can see the company's point of view because, they kind of want to protect their downline. The LOS line of sponsorship is theirs, essentially. That's, at least that's what the arbitrator ruled in this one case. But at the same time, I'm trained as a computer programmer in COBOL on punch cards. So obviously I'm not going back to that career. I got to be a professional network marketer. And if I'm into the health and nutrition industry and I leave one company, you know, how can they stop me from going to another health and nutrition MLM company and making a living? But you're right.
Right.
Arguments on both sides. But the last point on this issue is, what about the company that says, okay, we know some of our leaders are about to leave because they're in the process of selling their downlines. Corporate needs to prove that. So they got a heads up that they've got some leaders about to leave. So let's add into our policies right now, years after these guys have joined, a non-compete that was never there previously. You think that could ever – because these policies, and a lot of people listening to this probably don't even know that because most people don't even read their policies and procedures, but it says we can change these policies anytime we want, in any way we want, and usually what it says is you have 30 days to contest it or drop out or whatever you want to do, and a lot of them will say by cashing
take or leave it.
Check, you're essentially – agreeing to these changes. So
exactly.
If you know a leader's about to leave, so you throw in non-competes that were never there previously directly in preparation for their departure, you think that could ever stand up? Because that's happened.
Yeah, well, yeah, it has. It has stood up, and Amway did that. They didn't always have a data management rule, an LOS rule, and they didn't always have a non-compete. I think they enacted it in 2005. And what the rules do say, and I draft these rules for startup companies, the company needs to have some kind of mechanism to change its rules because, as you know, the laws change. So maybe a company finds religion and they want to have a retail sales rule. There needs to be a way for them to do that. And what they all do is they say, okay, we reserve the right to change it whenever we want. And that's pretty strong language. And basically it says, we're going to let you know via email, via written letter, and via magazines. And if you accept your checks, you're good with it, you're stuck with it. And some people have taken exception to that. They've litigated it, but not successfully.
Yeah, no, so, that part I agree with, that they can change it whenever they want. There's got to be some mechanism for doing that. But I meant specifically adding a non-compete that was not on the original policies that you signed and agreed to, and it was specifically in preparation for a leader's departure.
But it's the first element I don't have a problem with, them adding a non-compete, if these distributors are still cashing checks and still working the business. But the second element as far as doing it with the express purpose of fencing people in the fourth quarter, those facts might play in court. I don't know if it's compelling enough to get a judge to throw out the agreement.
Yeah, because like they said, well, these are people, by the way, who were in the process of selling their downlines. So the company knew they were about to leave.
Right.
Let's get a non-compete in here real quick, you know, before they officially resign their distributorships.
We usually non-competes are limited in duration. It's like 6 months. So if a distributor is willing to wait, when analyzing the Amway business, I was, or any contract for that matter, the non-competes aren't that big of a deal, right? Usually they say you can't sell competing products. So if you're in a different type of business, you're fine. But I understand your point is if you're well-versed in one industry, you don't want to change. So I get that. But usually the wait limit is 6 months, which is reasonable. So you can just chill out for 6 months. You can do whatever you want to do. It's the LOS issue that's always the most cumbersome.
Right.
And that's demonstrated by the fact that Woodward and those guys owe $25 million. It's serious.
6 months you can join another company. Just don't talk to your old downline.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You've got that issue.
It's got to rebuild from scratch.
Exactly. That's right.
Kevin, I really appreciate all the extra time that you spent. I know that we got into probably a lot of these things a little deeper than we had anticipated, and I really appreciate you hanging in there with me because this I think that there's a lot of interesting developments right now. It's good to have a discussion with someone who isn't completely on the same side because that's boring, and there's nothing to be gained from it. And it's great to be stretched. So I really appreciate you doing this with me and the extra time that you spent as well, too. I'm sure everybody will appreciate that.
You're very welcome. I'm honored. You're one of the best in the business, and I hope your audience learns something, and maybe we can do this in the future when there's some new developments, and we can talk, because I think this industry is going to change, and I think it's going to change for the better, and it's going to be through leadership from guys like you and various actions in the future. So we'll
right.
see what happens.
Yeah, like you said, there's a lot of evolving things happening coming up, so maybe in a few weeks or early next year we can revisit and see what the results of all of those were and kind of where we stand in the new year.
Sounds good. Will you take care, Lynn, and
right.
I look forward to hearing the program.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Bye. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right.